All right, it's Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunn. We will we'll talk to Mike Zeisberger of NHL.com at the bottom of the hour, getting you set for what might be the biggest matchup of the entire National Hockey League season to this point, is the red-hot Colorado Avalanche with Nathan MacKinnon back and healthy into Scotiabank Arena to play the red-hot Toronto Maple Leafs.
And Nazem Kadri bent on what?
I don't know. I thought you were going to say destruction.
Revenge. You know, I'll show them. I'm having a great year.
Yep.
They could have, boy, they could sure use me, et cetera, et cetera. He is having a great year. But yeah, this is a little more of a challenge than that California swing, which was not much of a challenge. Apparently not for this team. They just brushed them aside like bugs. But yeah, it should be a good hockey game.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it. And yes, okay, you can talk about that California road trip maybe not being the toughest. This is also a Toronto Maple Leafs team that lost 7-1 to a Pittsburgh Penguins team.
And it's in a whole other world, Ben. That didn't ever happen. Like, you don't understand that. That's, I don't even remember that.
Yeah, you're right. That was in the before times.
That was in the before times. That's right.
The 2-4-1 start and down 2-0 to the Chicago Blackhawks.
Okay. That can't be true.
And then that was like, yeah, that was BC. We're in AD now.
Yeah, that's exactly correct.
All right. Let's talk to David Sampson, former Major League executive, host of Nothing Personal with David Sampson. How's it going, David?
I'm doing okay. How you doing?
Doing very well. So we got a couple of questions we don't have answers for in regards to just the mechanics of this pending lockout. Like, we just had a conversation about James Paxton, who was just signed by the Boston Red Sox, who's coming off Tommy John surgery. And to our understanding, if you're a player in the middle of a lockout, you cannot enter a team facility. You can't even have contact with anybody in the team. What do you do if you're a player that's rehabbing that needs like medical attention over the next couple of months?
So what are you supposed to do or what do you really do?
Well, that's give us both. Yeah.
I'm going to give you both. So let's first start with any contract, by the way. Unless he has taken a physical and passed that physical and that deal has been confirmed by both the union and by the commissioner's office prior to the lockout, that deal will not be a deal and he will still be a free agent. That will not be a confirmed deal. So start with that. In terms of his rehab, that's the same as any injured player. Any player who is using team facilities now is going to be using non-team facilities. However, in the real world, what's going to happen is the teams are going to be working with the players to make sure that they know exactly what facilities they're in, who's putting their hands on the player, how their schedule is working in terms of rehab, because the lockout will end and the players want to be taken care of and the owners want to take care of the players, but it just won't be at the training room. And that's really not applicable. Like if you're a brewer, very few players live in there during the off season, right?
Right.
In Miami, it's a little different because a lot of Marlins players do use Marlins Park during the off season, and now they're going to have to go elsewhere. We would likely send them to the University of Miami to do their rehab. And so each team will decide what to do with its players.
So it's kind of a don't ask, don't tell situation here, right? Where that there's not going to be, there'll be contact maybe through third parties, but there's not going to be contact, I'm assuming, right? Like you're right. Both sides want the rehab to progress. Both sides want, learned people involved in it, but they have to make it appear that they're not connected.
Think of it like tampering, which is we all say no one does it, but everybody does it. So what they'll say during the lockout is, hey, we're not talking to them. They're not talking to us. It really doesn't mean that. This lockout is a procedural lockout that is being done after an impasse between management and a union with an expiring collective bargaining agreement. And when you reach an impasse, you can lock out your employees, and you do that to try to get them to the table in a more reasonable fashion. But right now, there's no skin in the game for either side to get a deal done today, tomorrow, or the next day, because that's the deadline of December 1st is not a real deadline because the players aren't missing money and neither are the owners right now. But come March 31st, a little earlier, really, for spring training. So let's just say come February 15th, that's when it gets serious.
Mm-hmm. How about, there's also nothing, David, to prevent general managers from talking among themselves, you know, potentially consummating it. Again, as long as they could consummate a deal that didn't involve, you know, something contractual where they would have to pull an agent in. Do you expect that when this lockout ends, there's going to be suddenly be an announcement of a whole bunch of deals that have been made?
Yes, I do, because there will be deals that can be talked about between teams, but you can't get your hands on a player in terms of a physical, which you do before before a deal is done. But you can have teams exchange medicals with each other, and that happens all the time, where you call up your, you know, the team, the Rockies, and you say, "Hey, I need." The trainer calls the trainer and says, "I need the medical on John Gray." I know he's not a Rocky anymore, but that's the first name that came to my head. I have no idea why. So that kind of stuff will continue to happen. And there will also be contact, even though everyone's going to deny it, there will be contact with free agents, because there will not be a lot of time for the remaining free agents, and there are hundreds of them, to find jobs all in a short period of time. And teams want to get the roster together. Players want to get settled where they're going to be. So there's going to be plenty of contact. And that's okay. That's not going to hurt or help the negotiation.
What form? So that is that literally somebody calling somebody on their cell phone? Like, how, what form is that contact going to take?
What I did during negotiations is we would speak to agents, we would speak to the players directly, we would speak to people who knew the players. So we would do all sorts of ways, but it's not nefarious, right? We all have relationships with our players. We all have each other's cell phones. We all text back and forth all the time. And during all the labor negotiations, I was very much close with our player rep. And I would just, we'd talk all the time and just say, here's what we're thinking. Where are you guys on this? Is there any momentum? And I would report a lot of that to Dan or to Rob or to Bud. But many of times I just would keep it to myself, because it really was not an impactful conversation.
So this is a bizarre lockout for a number of different reasons, not the least of which is that there's an 8-man union subcommittee where two of the members just under the wire signed massive, massive contracts in Marcus Semien and Max Scherzer. That feels like it should be impactful and interesting information and bizarre. Like, how should I be taking that?
You should take it that players and agents went to the owners and said, if you want to sign my guy, here's the number you have to hit, and you better sign him, because you don't want to wait till February, because who knows what could happen. And don't you want to have a good New Year's Eve and a good Christmas and Hanukkah and know that your roster is together while other teams are going to be chasing their tails once this lockout ends? So just give me $43 million over 3 years, or give me a 7-year deal or a 10-year deal. Do exactly what I want, and then we'll have a deal. And that's why every deal that happened, in my opinion, and I mean that, every deal was an overpay in this last frenzy of 3 days.
Well, I guess about more specifically, Semien and Scherzer, because they're going to decide whether the negotiation, you know, whether to accept something that the league hands them or not. And their incentive is to resume playing so that they can get paid, because they just signed massive deals. And, you know, Scherzer's made hundreds of millions of dollars, and Semien did well. But this is like this is the biggest contract he'll ever sign in his entire life. And whether there's, you know, whether that would muddy the waters a little bit in negotiations, considering that those guys just signed big deals.
Yeah, you'd be shocked how little sway the members of the executive council have over the rank and file of the union. And you'd be shocked how little they have to do with the negotiation that takes place. It's really Bruce Mayer who's doing it. It's really Tony Clark. And then they give summaries to the players to read, just like Dan Helm and Rob Manfred give summaries to the owners. Not one player, not one owner reads the full collective bargaining agreement. It's always the summary memo that comes out, and that's really how the votes are cast on both sides. So I don't view Scherzer as anything other than a mouthpiece of Boris, and neither do the owners, and neither do the other players, quite frankly. So if you ask players, they'll tell you in a quiet moment when no one's listening that they look at someone like Scherzer and they don't pay any attention to what he says, because they know exactly that it is all about Boris trying to exert power within these negotiations. So the purpose of having players at the table is just from a representative standpoint. So it looks like they're at the table and that they're engaged. It's the same thing with all the different owners at the table. You know, Dick Monfort was at a meeting with Dan Helm, and 5 years ago was Ron Fowler, who was very involved. But at the end of the day, it is the commissioner's office that really pushes the wagon, and it's the union leadership that pushes the wagon on the other side.
David, Boris, he was on the Zoom call with Scherzer today. He looked pretty happy. He looked pretty – I don't know why, but he seemed very pleased with himself and with the situation. Again, it's not just Boris, but what do agents – What does Scott Boras want to come out of this collective negotiation?
He wants the ability to have, he wants the ability to, excuse me, I'm sorry about that. He wants the ability to actually have drafted players make as much money as possible, and he wants more teams competing every year so there's more teams with higher payrolls competing for their own players, for his own players. So his goal is very simple. He would love a salary floor because that would get teams like the Guardians and the Marlins and the Pirates and the Orioles. That's another $300 million in total payroll that's not being spent, and that's got to go to players. And Boras feels like that's more opportunities for his players to get contracts.
Yeah.
No, so with drafted players, yeah, he wants Harper, right?
Yeah.
Harper with those huge signing bonuses, Strasburg with the huge signing bonuses, that's what he wants. And right now, the number one pick can't get that huge a bonus because it's slotted.
But I was thinking that, the system is, he's like the fact that he can, not necessarily waste time on guys in their early years and then come and scoop them right before free agency. Like this, he's worked this system pretty well. Which kind of gets around the fact that guys don't get paid in their first few years. Cause for a lot of them, he's not representing them in their first few years.
And so what's funny about that, and no one has written about this, Scott Boras really doesn't care much about pre-arbitration years and the minimum salary.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't really care as much as you think about arbitration. He wants free agency as quickly as possible. He would give up all of arbitration and let players be paid the minimum for 5 years if he could guarantee that everyone was a free agent after 5 years instead of 6 years. And ironically, I tried during my 18 years to get free agency every year. I wanted players to be free agents after 1 year of service, and I could never get the union to agree, because if you do free agency after 1 year, that means that you have to be good every single year or else you're going to be out of the game or not making any money, and you have to prove yourself every year. So I'd be in favor of 1 year deals. Everybody's a free agent at all times, but agents really do not want that.
Oh yeah. I could see that one for sure. They like the one where you can sign a 7-year deal, like your Marcus Semien and keep making, your $25 million bucks until you're 37. The interesting thing for fans during this negotiation will be the rule change stuff, the expanded playoffs, the universal DH. Do you expect that to be the easiest part of the negotiation? Is that like when everything's settled monetarily and arbitration's figured out, that's like the last thing we hear about is them exchanging ideas on playoff teams, playoff structure, that type of thing?
Well, the universal DH is actually an economic issue because the way the commissioner's office looks at it is that a minimum guy, let's just say for easy math, is making $500,000. And the average for a DH in the American League, let's say, is $8 million. So if there are 15 more jobs where those players will get $7.5 million more, you're talking about, another $100 million of payroll going to players. So if for the owners to give universal DH to the players, they're going to want something back, something equivalent, because they're putting more money into the payroll system, into the expenses side. On the expanded playoffs, it's the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Players don't get paid extra money for playoffs except a pittance, which is the playoff share. Like if you lose in the division series, maybe 20 to 30 grand is all you get. And if you win the World Series, you can get up to maybe 350 grand. So it's, for minimum players, it's great, but it's really not enough. But what owners get with expanded playoffs is more national TV money and a lot more. So that is viewed by players as an economic gift to have more playoff teams. So those are going to be trades that get made as part of the core economic proposals that'll be going back and forth from now through February.
David, always insightful. Thanks for this.
Hey, anytime. I'll be around throughout the lockout.
All right.
We'll call.
Yes, we will. See you, David. It's David Sampson, former Major League executive, host of Nothing Personal with David Sampson, who, yes, that's the seedy underbelly of the Scott Boras idea, is that he cares about you until he doesn't, or he doesn't care about you until he does.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Like it's one of those things that, I don't think Scott Boras is evil or any of that stuff. And
no.
I think agents, if I'd want a really good agent, if I was a professional athlete, I want him to get me as much money as he possibly could. Scott Boras has been pretty good at that. But, one of the truths about baseball, especially because of the long preamble before you're a free agent, is, agents sign guys, either drafted players or international players when they're really young and they make no money.
Mm-hmm.
And then for several years. They follow those guys around and try and, you know, build that relationship, especially if you're not a big time agent, and kind of you look after that guy, you look after his relatives, when he has to take his rental car back, you take it back for him, you do all this stuff. And then 6 months before he goes to free agency, he calls you and said, I just fired you. Scott Boras is my agent. That happens all the time.
Well, and it can be quite the story. Like an Aaron Sanchez who does that, is about to hit free agency, leading the American League in ERA. Guess what? Scott Boras no longer is agent because he's not a moneymaker anymore. That's
it. I was there we were shooting with Sanchez at his house, at his parents' place, when he hired Scott Boras. And dumped whoever his former agent was. And you're right. Yeah, he was on the verge of something. And then Scott Boras's guy shows up. Mm-hmm. A guy shows up from Scott Boras's office where, you know, in Barstow, California, in the middle of nowhere. And suddenly there's this dude shows up from, starts telling us what we can and can't do, shooting this piece, you know, that we're, and to Aaron's credit, he told the guy to go away.
Yeah.
But that's what happened. So to demonstrate that, you know, he was now agenting, mm-hmm. he sent some lackey from his office to go and order us around and, you know, spend a lot of time on his cell phone otherwise. But it's, like, I met a guy, you know, I've talked about this before, but, you know, a young agent who was hanging out with a guy who was, you know, I won't mention the name now, but, you know, in that situation where he was following him around and he was his buddy and they were, you know, they did all kinds of stuff together and solved, and he told me about solving problems for other players. And, you know, guys are in the minor leagues, they're not making any money, sending money to a guy's relatives, again, finding him a car, all this stuff in the hope that when the moment came that they would get to negotiate the first big contract and get their piece of the action. Because otherwise they're not making any money. Like, and again, no tag days for agents. I get that. But it's a brutal, brutal business because, honest to God, a player can, you know, almost up until the day he signs a free agent deal, can fire an agent. And, well, literally up until the day. You could fire the guy the day before.
Right.
And bring in another guy, and he gets the percentage.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
It's so, you know, it's
got 4% of 100 million is a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. And 4% of, you know, 250 grand or 500 grand or what's the major league minimum, 500 grand is less.
Yes.
Right? So, yeah, Scott Boras probably doesn't really care about arbitration or major league minimums.
Yeah.
Because he swoops in with that big smile on his face and, yeah, like he's the apex predator, right?
Yep.
God love him.
Yeah, and he's already got the Scherzer money in pocket, doing all right on that. Yeah, the Semien Scherzer thing, and yes, I point understood about how that executive committee is not actually doing the hard negotiating, I suppose, but it is. It's a weird thing.
Yes.
It's a bit strange. I mean,
yeah, they're not exactly marching with their fists up in the air saying tear the system down, right? Because it's not that kind of a negotiation. But there is, it would seem that the current system that they're going to fight to change here, although they're being, by the way, they are being locked out. They're not, so it's not, that's the owner's lockout. We should always call it that, like many union leaders have. It is the owner's lockout. But a system that they believe on some level is unfair has just rewarded them enormously.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know what? Maybe there's some altruism there. Even that being the case, it's, you know, it's benefiting us, but it's not benefiting the guy who doesn't get to 6 years of service
there's
time.
Nothing preventing them from showering the world with dollar bills, right? They could do that. They could go and give every minor league player $100.
Speaking of altruism and dollar bills, man, hard to be cynical about Steve Simon and the WTA.
Mm-hmm.
The chairman and CEO of the WTA today, with this statement: with the full support of the WTA board of directors, I am announcing the immediate suspension of all WTA tournaments in China, including Hong Kong. In good conscience, I don't see how I can ask our athletes to compete there when Peng Shuai is not allowed to communicate freely and has seemingly been pressured to contradict her allegation of sexual assault. Given the current state of affairs, I'm also greatly concerned about the risk that all of our players and staff could face if we were to hold events in China in 2022. That's it. There's a couple of events, and a couple of years ago they happened around the end of the year, into the early part of the new year, in both China and Hong Kong. And he said, not happening. Will not happen until I see Peng Shuai, like, in person, it sounds like.
It's astounding. And it shouldn't be astounding because it's, you know, kind of a point of principle and a principle that pretty much everyone would agree with, except for Dick Pound, which we'll get to him in a second.
Yeah.
But it, you know, somebody actually putting something above money, you know, like a business putting money, something above money, because they're, you know, look, that it's a significant amount of money, those two tournaments, number one, right? And it's, you know, you're going from that to zero. I'm sure they could, maybe they can stage a tournament somewhere else, but everybody wants to be in China. Everybody wants to do business in China because of the size of the market. Every sport is clamoring to get in there for one way or another. So, and, you know, they've basically drawn a line. It's not like China's going to call you guys are right. You know, you guys are right. We're not going to do this anymore. And please bring your tournaments back here. No, this, they just declared war here, right? On a point of principle, and a great point of principle. I guess maybe it's so shocking because we just don't ever see it.
No,
right? A lot of lip service paid, and
there's not
lip service, man.
There's no, like, the language is so specific and so direct, and the action is so specific. We're not going to China or Hong Kong until this is resolved. And the IOC, you can tell us that you had a 30-minute Zoom conversation with Peng Shuai, even though you won't even release the video of it, which is like, that's like step one. How about like some transparency there that we even have an idea of what you talked about? You won't even do that.
Well, that's a whole other thing. But before we get, I just say, like, there isn't a government in the world that would take this hard a stand against China.
Yeah, and you know what? But I don't know. I'm wishy-washy on that because I also don't want World War III.
No, I know. You also probably don't want them to call in, you know, the debt that they hold, right?
Yes.
Like, no, there's a whole bunch of things. Yeah, World War III would be bad. The collapse of the world.
The official stance of the Fan Drive Time is World War III would be bad.
We take a stand too, and the collapse of the world economy would be just slightly less bad, but they could probably facilitate that too, right? If they wanted to, pull the rug out from under all of us. So yeah, nobody. People are going to kind of tippy-tap around this and say, well, you guys are really bad. You're doing bad things. But please, don't do that. This is unequivocal. It's spectacular. But now, tell me, because, I missed Dick Pound on CNN. Somebody, for his own good, shouldn't somebody say, don't do this? You know, you are now the face of, you know, you're making yourself the spokesperson for something that is, you know, morally untenable. That you're the apologist, you're the guy defending the indefensible. Why do you know I'm not sure why the IOC wants him on. Maybe they don't. Maybe he's just freelancing. But my God, do you want to be that guy?
No, he was on live from Montreal with Aaron Burnett on CNN today, and the talking point was essentially, you know, people are making things up and they have less information than we have. Why is our information not good? We have direct contact with China, with Peng Shuai. We're the only people that have talked to her. Well, okay, if that, I mean, step one, like I said, would be, can we at least see the conversation? You've told us the minutes of the 30-minute conversation that you've had, but like that seems like an easy step one for you to do is just, hey, we can actually look at the questions you asked, which we know none of them were about the alleged sexual assault that she put, not pen to paper, but finger to the keyboard at the beginning of November, and then had that tweet or whatever they call it in the Chinese version of Twitter deleted. We know there was none of that. Was there ever a question about, hey, can you prove that you're not being coerced? Where exactly in China are you? Are you going to be out of China? Like, there was the idea that we're just supposed to accept that just blanket and there would be not even an offering of proof is beyond the pale.
Well, it is. It's, although it's pretty, you know, again, if you think of the entire history of the International Olympic Committee, it's not that but
par for the course.
The notion that you could go to the public and say, trust us.
Yeah.
Number one, like, we are truth tellers, right? Look at our history. We always tell the truth about stuff. We want to get to the bottom of stuff. Look at what we did with doping, man. We got to it took us a while. Well, you know, we overlooked a lot of stuff. Well, some countries we treated differently than other countries. And we've never, you know, we've overlooked any, you know, we've always, you know, champions of human rights gone into countries where we're, you know, the Olympics changes things. When you put the Olympics in a country, they see the error of their ways and they change things. Come on. Like, you know, like, this, it's unbelievable that he could be that tone deaf, that obtuse. And that, you know, that again, that I can't believe that, you know, like, even the guys in Lausanne, you know, Thomas Bach and the various dukes and people who are on the IOC, like, is this the guy? You want him out there saying, hey, why, you know, what's the big deal here?
Well, yeah, and he basically, he talked about that. Yeah, it was basically a couple of Olympians talking to each other. They were having a chat about, you know, athletics and, you know, how great that was.
It's just, it's mind-blowing. And I say somebody for his own good, if you're a friend of his, tell him not to go on TV anymore. Mm-hmm. But yeah, please hold people's feet to the fire here. And again, tip of the cap to the folks, not that they need us to do it, but to the WTA, the people who run the WTA, for having some stones.
Well, and I'm going to hold on to my Pollyanna view that this is actually going to be impactful to other leagues who do business in China, that hopefully.
I hope you're right.
I mean, but we're going to find out. We're going to find out what, one, the economic impact is and the fallout from the WTA, and it'll cost them money. Like, whatever, you know, money they make through, I don't know, attention, other people who are maybe, like myself, becoming bigger fans of the WTA, it's not going to equal what they lose by losing those two tournaments, so it won't be economic. But what is the fallout from this? And I, as much as my fingers are crossed that it's going to work out well for them, I really don't see the scenario where China just gives it up and Peng Shuai is in North America and she speaks her full truth.
I think that would be unlikely.
Yeah.
You know, look, China's not the only bad actor in the world. But this, you know, a big part of this, and it's, you know, is the WTA standing up for one of their own athletes.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and that's it. And I think Steve Simon has referenced that he has a personal relationship with this woman that he wants to make sure that she's not locked into a re-education camp.
Yes. And it's not. That's not an exaggeration.
Yeah.
And, you know, the women of the WTA, the athletes who are the WTA, right? That's, you know, they're standing by one of their, you know, co-competitors. There's some, you know, somebody who they know, somebody who they competed against, somebody who's a friend, somebody, you know, to whom something terrible. Like, again, you would hope that human beings would react this way, that there at some point, when you dig down far enough, eventually you hit principle. Mm-hmm. And I think it's admirable and it's gutsy and it's risky for the business, but I think it's kind of behooves the rest of us to at least cheer them on.
Yeah, and that's what I'll do. And then we'll cheer on the Toronto Maple Leafs, perhaps, or at least we'll cheer on a competitive game between the Leafs and the Colorado Avalanche tonight at Scotiabank Arena. And Michael Hutchinson, who is back, by the way.
Really?
You thought you
Where
were done.
Where was
he? He was in the AHL.
Oh, okay.
The guy who I guess is going to go off and do great things in his career is a direct result of me saying that he couldn't do it. Joseph Woll is out with an injury.
Oh.
So that's why Michael.
Okay, I was wondering.
Out.
I was going to say, I was trying to wrap my head around how this could possibly. He's not, like, it's.
He's banged up is the way Elliot Friedman described it. So it's not like a career-ending injury or anything, or anything significant. But it has resulted in Michael Hutchinson being the backup for tonight's game. Toronto Maple Leafs and Colorado Avalanche. We'll talk to Mike Zeisberger of NHL.com next. The Fan Drive Time continues. Ben Annis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
You know, obviously when it happened, it's a bit of a, you know, bitter situation, but it ended up being a little bit bittersweet. You know, I was put in a great situation with, you know, coming to the Avalanche and being around a great group of guys. So, of course, I was upset. You know, that's... you know, that's where I wanted to be at the time, but you know, sometimes you know, it can be a blessing in disguise.
Why do you think it ended?
Why? It's not a question for me.
I think I know the answer. That was Nazem Kadri in his media availability today before the Avalanche in Toronto Maple Leafs square off at Scotiabank Arena, where we will find our next guest. Mike Zeisberger of NHL.com joins us online right now. How's it going, Mike?
I'm doing well, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for doing it. How does history view the Kadri deal, in your opinion?
Well, let's not go through revisionist history here, first of all, okay? Here's the deal. And look, I'm a huge Nazem Kadri fan. I was from the moment that they drafted him. You know, I remember talking to Peter DeBoer, who coached him in Kitchener, and saying, like, he wasn't comparing him to Doug Gilmour, but he compared him as having some same kind of skill sets as a center who could, you know, had an offensive upside, which we've seen with 23 points in the past 12 games with the Avalanche, while MacKinnon has been out. But also, he was the type of guy, you know, that type of playoff performer that could get under people's skin. So, and we've also seen that, too. So from that standpoint, I'm a big Kadri fan. But for me, it's pretty easy to see why that he was let go. I mean, if you look at it, okay, when the Leafs were starting to gel, they were this core of players was coming up. It was not just good enough to make the playoffs like they had against the Washington Capitals in 17. They go into the 2018 playoffs, and Kadri gets suspended against the Boston Bruins in the first round, and the Leafs still made it to game seven. They were actually winning going into the third period of game seven before, you know, we all know that Boston came back. But you just sit there and wonder, you know, they were that close. What would have been like if they would have had Kadri in the lineup for the majority of the next season? So follow along my logic here. They go out and get John Tavares. And one of the reasons that summer, one of the reasons was they envisioned going into the playoffs. You know what? If we have John Tavares, Austin Matthews, and Nazem Kadri as our top three forwards, top three centers up the middle, that is going to be a lot for other teams to deal with. And they were right. And then they go into Boston for the first two games. And not only does Kadri get suspended again, but he got suspended. And we highlighted it, guys, by taking runs at a player at the exact piece of board. So you guys know how the boards are put up. Like they're put up in like rectangular sheets. The exact same rectangular sheet at the TD Garden that where he had run somebody the year before to get suspended. So, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. And I think that's the way that the Maple Leafs looked at it. Like, how could this happen again? Now, did the Tyson Barrie thing work out? No, not really. But, you know, and I'm not saying, you know, right now people look and say, well, it was Kadri for Kerfoot. You can't just look at the stats, okay? It happened twice in a row at the most crucial time, which would be in the playoffs. So that's my long-winded way of saying, you know what, you can't just look at who they gave up and who they got back. You know, the fact that he had done it 2 years in a row, I just think the team just said, you know, he's a talented guy, but we have to move on. And I'm not so sure I disagree with that.
Well, it's one of those, yeah, history, you know, it's easy to kind of look in the rearview mirror and say, but man, you sold low on the guy as it turned out.
Let me interrupt for a second.
Yeah, go ahead.
Like, so you're watching that game and he does it again.
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
I get it.
What's going through your mind? Are you, and you're not the emotional fan. You're the logical thinking, you know, we all know, the foundation, the solid foundation that you built your career on. Are you thinking at that time, well, this guy's got to come back next year so we can see it all over again?
Yeah, I understand. I understand the logic. I absolutely do. And I understand saying, no, that's it, right? That's, you know, we've waited. We think the guys, we obviously see the talent. We drafted him. We like the player, but there's something there that is preventing him from, you know, getting past that point, right? From not doing that in that kind of a situation. That's a flaw. And, you know, at a certain point as an organization, maybe decide the flaw is not going to get corrected, right? That we'll let somebody else take that risk, but we don't believe it anymore. And I think they must have got to that point.
And you know what? It's too bad because, like I said, I like the way that Kadri plays on the ice. I like him as a person very much off the ice. You know, and especially at playoff time with this team having such, we all know that they haven't been past the first round since 2004. And you watch Kadri in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. This is the type of player that any team looks at when the playoffs come around and real estate is harder to come by out on the ice. This is the type of player that you look at and say, this is a playoff type guy. He wears his heart on his sleeves. And I think that is the difficulty in making a move like that. And it becomes even more difficult when you see a guy with, you know, at least offensively with a high ceiling like Tyson Barrie has and had, and it just didn't work here. And I think that sometimes when people look back, that changes the narrative of the entire trade in which they go, well, we didn't get enough for him.
What about if you do the unfair thing and you look at the way it played out and you look at how poorly Tyson Barrie played as a member of the Toronto Maple Leafs and you look at, you know, Alex Kerfoot, who was sold as a centerman when he was acquired from the Colorado Avalanche and his best position on this team being a winger, and that Nassim Kadri has turned into a top five scorer in the NHL. Then would you have, if you knew all that, would you have just, you know, rolled the dice again on Nassim Kadri not getting suspended in the playoffs and just, you know, tried it out anyways?
I don't know if I can go back and say, okay, yeah, I would have changed my mind, because it's not, you know, that it's not realistic. And you know, I mean, maybe I changed my mind, 5 months down the road, if Nazem Kadri finishes in the top five of NHL scoring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's going to change just by the fact that Nathan MacKinnon is going to be back in the lineup. And that's not to take anything away from what Nazem Kadri has done. I just feel that there's sometimes where you have to move on. And let's not forget, too, you know, a couple of years before that, Kadri was suspended for a game for being late, for mm-hmm. at least as the story goes, for being late for a meeting. And then Brendan Shanahan came out and suspended him for another game. You know, so, and like I said, I do like Kadri and I like him as a person, but, you know, there's certain, at certain points in the in the life of an organization, I think the people that running the team just get to the point where they say, okay, you know what? I mean, we just need a new look. We need we need a change of scenery to bring somebody in and get this guy out. And, you know, I'm very happy for Naz in the way that he's succeeded in Colorado. But like I've said, all this revisionist history that is coming out, you know, I would have liked to ask the same people that are saying now, oh, they should have never made that trade, what they were thinking of that night in Boston when he took the run at the guy for the second time.
Look, I know this is, I'm going to ask you an impossible question, especially these days when access is so limited to players, but do you think there was pressure in the room as well, maybe to move? Cause you know, those guys, his teammates saw him, they saw those suspensions, and they were there when he showed up late. And whatever happened around that. And did you think, you know, we talk a lot about team culture these days in all sports. Everybody talks about it. Do you think that there was pressure in, you know, from within the group saying, you got to get this guy out of here?
Well, first of all, let's address the thing about the team meeting. Like I said, I don't think Kadri is a bad guy. I think that he made a mistake at that point. If you remember, that was early on in the Lou Lamoriello mm-hmm. regime. So some of the younger guys that are the core of the team today, might not have even been around at that time. But, you know, I think what it did show, Stephen, is the fact that we all know Lou Lamoriello is a no-nonsense type of guy. So when that happened and they suspended him, my first thought was, well, there's no way that Lou is going to put up with this. I mean, Lou is pretty much, okay, that's it. We're not going to deal with you that way. But they stuck with it. And I'm not sure of the timing, but he may have gotten his extension after that situation. I'm not 100% sure. So if Lou Lamoriello saw something in this kid's character at the time that overcame what he had done and missing the meeting, then you've got to think that, you know, something is there that Lou Lamoriello saw that showed him that, you know what, this is a stand-up kid that just made a mistake. So in that regard, you know, I'm not sure how much of an effect it would have had in the room. I'm sure that there were guys that were disappointed at that, but I don't think, you know, guys in that room looked at it and said, well, if Kadri hadn't done that, maybe we would have won the series. Because I think guys are more accountable than that. And I think they probably beat themselves up before that. But I think from those of us, you know, from an organizational standpoint, whether it be Kyle Dubas, whether it be Brendan Shanahan, or whether it be, you know, the fans or like the rest of us in the media that take a step back and look at the big picture, it's just like, you know, we can't let this happen again.
Yeah. And listen, I'll say that I was very much in that spot as well when it happened. I talked about it before that series, and then when it happened, it was almost unbelievable that it did happen. And it was not at all a surprise to see the Maple Leafs move off of Nazem Kadri. And you know what? It's worked out for Kadri and the Maple Leafs. Yep. It's worked out for them, at least so far during the regular season, Zeiss. It does help, though, to have a Vezina-caliber goaltender, which Jack Campbell has been to this point. He's at the end of his contract. There was that rumor earlier on in the season when he was still putting up these numbers, and it's only continued since then, that there would be a negotiation of an extension with him in season. Do you see it happening? It would be for a big number considering what he's accomplished already.
Yeah, I do. And I'll tell you why. Number one, I think that, you know, Kyle Dubas is very, very familiar with this player going back to their days with the Sioux Greyhounds. And number two, I mean, the only thing, and it hasn't been so much this year, but last year, I mean, the only thing that kept Jack Campbell from, producing even better numbers was the fact that he broke down physically a little bit last year. This year, knock on wood, he's been pretty good in that respect. Kudos to the way that the team is playing in front of him. I mean, limiting second chance opportunities, I think, has been huge for this team. We saw that with the way that they, you know, Joseph Woll played great in his handful of games for the Maple Leafs, but you saw the way that the guys were clearing rebounds, and they've been doing that for Campbell too. So I think it's very important with Mrazek being back on the ice that he gets back to give Campbell a little bit of a rest. But no, I just think with if you add between the way that he has played since he joined the Maple Leafs and add on to the fact that management has had a history with this player, it would not be surprising to me if they get him locked up, because we know how important goaltending is. Now, how they do that, you know, in the salary cap pie, you know, your guess is as good as mine. But I didn't think they could get Morgan Rielly signed to a long-term deal either, and they managed to do that.
What's the timeline in terms of Mrazek being back and game ready?
I wouldn't be surprised to see him back within the next week, Stephen, and that would be interesting. I'm not sure if he'll be ready for the weekend games, back-to-backs with Winnipeg and Minnesota. But, within the next week, I would not be surprised to see him in there. And that's big, like I said, because we saw last year that, Campbell was a little bit fragile. And he's obviously proven himself to be the number one goalie. I know at the beginning of the season, the Leafs were saying, okay, it's going to be a goaltending battle, yada, yada, yada. We know who the starting goaltender for this team is. But you don't want him playing 55 or 60 games, especially in a market like this and with an organization like this that understands no matter what they do in the regular season, all the eyeballs are going to be on them come April. That is where they are going to be judged. That is going to be the litmus test of this roster. And that is, you know, why it's so important to make sure that this guy stays healthy, and that part and parcel is with having a good backup that can take some of the workload off him.
But he will be starting tonight against a pretty good test in the Colorado Avalanche. Zeiss, appreciate the time.
Yeah. Thank you very much for having me, guys, and have a great night.
Thanks, Zeiss.
All right, you too. Mike Zeisberger, NHL.com. Yeah, so I mentioned that, you know, that Michael Hutchinson is back in people's lives. Mm-hmm. And when people saw, because that news came out before there was any explanation, it was just Michael Hutchinson recalled from the American Hockey League. Twitter had a couple of seconds there where they had an absolute meltdown thinking that, hey, Joseph Woll's been so good. It's not a result of performance. Uh-huh. And Jack Campbell's played a trillion games. This is the nightmare scenario that Jack Campbell has been overexposed. He's been overused and he has broken down. And here's your goaltending duo. Instead of Peter Mrazek and Jack Campbell, it's Joseph Woll and Michael Hutchinson.
Yes. And it's December 1st. So that would be kind of early for the breakdown to happen, I think. Yeah. Yeah. I can understand. Well, it's good that Twitter had a little,
yeah,
little conniption there. That's so no, it's not. That's no worries. And the original goaltending tandem will be reunited, it would appear, within the week.
Yes. salad days for the Toronto Maple Leafs. But yeah, I don't know. Okay, I guess the narrative train could go in the other direction. I mean, they have some very quality opponents coming up.
It's an interesting stretch. This is actually going to be kind of fun because they, again, they the business, like, you know, the briefcase tour of California, right?
That's
all
right.
Business, but it was not a lot of resistance there. There's going to be some resistance in the next little while here. This is a really interesting stretch of the schedule.
Oh, it absolutely is. And I can't wait to watch this game tonight on Sports.Ontario, by the way, as well. Raptors have this game's at Scotiabank Arena. Raptors have been awful at Scotiabank Arena.
It's okay if I didn't watch. I went to see Martha Wainwright last night, by the way, which was really good.
Yeah, you're forgiven.
She's awesome. So I missed the Raptors last night. Is that okay? Because I thought it might be a missable game. I was right, wasn't I?
Yeah, you were proven correct. The Raptors have difficulty scoring when already they started the season as a team that you could predict was going to have a tough time finding offense. And then when you have two of your most productive offensive players on the shelf and Gary Trent Jr. and OG Anunoby, that's a tough time. And so that is tied into this. They're 2-8 at home after... You know, it was expected that the return to Scotiabank Arena would help everything about this team. And so much of what went wrong last year was it was a COVID weird year, but they were playing in Tampa. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were nights at home where the home fans were booing them. They were cheering the opposition. Well, they're back in Toronto and, you know, the fans were delirious with excitement on that first home game where there was a full crowd at Scotiabank Arena. That has not been the problem. It's been the team on the floor that's been the problem.
No, look, if they were fully, I listened to Will Liu on the way home last night, by the way, mm-hmm. who sounded kind of glum, but he's probably appropriately so on the post game. But look, there's just not enough there right now. And if this team was fully 100% healthy at this moment, you know, we probably would be talking about, you know, whether they could scrap their way into the play-in. But they're not, and there's just not enough there. And I wonder when the conversation pivots to can they scrape their way into the play-in tournament to whither, you know, where are we headed here, mm-hmm. right? Where are we headed? What's the plan? And what are the foundation pieces? And what's the timeline?
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I keep bringing up Pascal Siakam and him being 27 as if, like, that's some ancient age. But it like, compared to the rest of the group, and by the way, it was pointed out that with Goran Dragic away from this team, they are the youngest team in the entire NBA, which is, you know, that's not something you should gloss over. That's a significant piece, you know, of the equation.
And young can be good as long as when you get a little older, you get better.
Yeah, and that needs to happen, especially on the defensive end for this team, because that's been one of the most surprising things. Maybe it shouldn't be, because so much of defense, like you think of defense as guys, you know, getting up close to somebody and swatting passes down and blocking people at the rim. Well, it's also defensive rebounding, and they didn't go into the season with a legitimate center.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't developed a definitive, actual by definition center, and Kem Birch has filled the position admirably at times, but he's not a 7-footer, and Precious Achiuwa, he's had some moments as well, but they've been one of the worst teams in the NBA at closing out defensive possessions. And that means getting rebounds. And that's, I mean, as much as this front office has done an incredible job and won a championship in 2019, that position, the five, the center position is really, it's just been a massive hole the last couple of years.
It really has. You also realize that, you know, any kind of, like when you take OG Anunoby out of the equation, like we talk about Fred VanVleet, who's, you know, it was working like a dog and playing a ton of minutes and giving it everything and Siakam, but boy, you take an Anunoby out of that mix.
Yep.
There's a huge hole there, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. Both sides of the ball, too.
Yeah.
Defensively, offensively. All right. Just over 5 hours to go until the owners say, everybody go home for Christmas. And then hopefully emerge before February. We'll see. we'll react to the Major League Baseball pending lockout tomorrow. It's the Fan Drive Time. Sportsnet 590, The Fan.